I call to order the House Committee on Human Services. I think we have a quorum, so we don't need to.
That would probably be better, John.
So I also open up an informational meeting, and Jim Edge is going to be talking with us about the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. Thanks for coming, Jim. Sorry we couldn't hear you last week.
That's fine.
Yeah, we were on a roll, too, last week.
Yeah.
But now he has the first slot in our undivided attention.
Right. We're wide awake.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Edge. I'm an assistant DHS director with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And as you just mentioned, last Wednesday, I guess it was, we had a DHS overview for you. Each of the divisions in the Department of Human Services did a brief presentation after the big overview that Dr. Goldberg did. And unfortunately, we didn't quite get to the very last division, which is the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. So I'll try to make it brief this morning. I know you have other topics to go on to, but I'll give you that brief presentation of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. Division of Medical Assistance Programs, sometimes known as DMAP, is the part of the Department of Human Services that oversees the Medicaid agency, all except long-term care Medicaid. And you heard about long-term care last week when seniors and people with disabilities talked. DMAP administers what's called the Oregon Health Plan, which is Oregon's version of Medicaid, operated as a demonstration project under waivers from the federal government, because we operate a program that's a little bit different than traditional Medicaid. We began that in 1994, operating a Medicaid program with some unique features, one of them being the prioritized list of health services, which I'll get to in just a minute. And with the savings that we achieved from the prioritized list of health services primarily, we began serving more people, and we served a population called the Oregon Health Plan Standard Population today, which is low-income people who don't qualify for traditional Medicaid, but they're below 100% of the federal poverty level. And that was the trade-off, or the thing that was funded with the savings from that prioritized list. The Oregon Health Plan serves about 432,000 people. That's the population from the last full month that we have population numbers for, last November, about 1 in 9 Oregonians. We serve about 1 in 4 children in Oregon, and we actually pay for more than 40% of the births in Oregon. So of the younger populations, we serve a higher percentage. During the past biennium, we've served a total of about 750,000 people, and that number is higher than the 432,000 I just mentioned, because people come on and off the Oregon Health Plan as they need it, as their circumstances change, as their employment might change, or their personal family situation changes. They cycle on and off the program. 432,000 is the number that was on the program at one time in November. And of that, about 368,000 qualified for the OHP Plus benefit package. And I'll get to the benefit packages of the Oregon Health Plan in just a minute. Oregon Health Plan Standard, as I mentioned, is our expansion population. That program currently is funded with provider taxes, not with state general funds, and federal matching funds on those provider taxes, and operates at an average of 24,000 clients. And we have a program called CHIP, or the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is for children who have incomes just a little higher than incomes that would allow them to qualify for a regular Medicaid, up to 185% of the federal poverty level in Oregon. One of the unique features of the Oregon Health Plan is what we call the prioritized list of health services. And that list is overseen by a commission called the Health Services Commission, appointed by the governor. And they have a process whereby they look at all of the health services provided to Oregonians through the Oregon Health Plan. They rank them in priority order based on evidence-based medicine and value to society. They update that list at least biennially. Actually, it's usually annually that they update that list and keep it up to date. And that list is currently 680 lines long, and the Oregon and through the Oregon Health Plan, we pay for lines 1 through 503 of the prioritized list. Moving to the specific programs overseen by the Oregon Health Plan, we have what's called Oregon Health Plan Medicaid. That's the federally mandated populations that we serve, low-income children, adults, pregnant women, blind and disabled, and low-income elderly. Also in Oregon Health Plan Medicaid, there's the OHP Standard Program. And there's a small program that is located actually outside of our agency called the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or FEHAP, which operates an insurance premium assistance program in the Office of Private Health Partnerships. There's another program that OHP operates called OHP CHIP, or OHP Children's Health Insurance Program. That's for children up through age 18, up to age 19, up to 100, above the income level that qualifies them for traditional Medicaid, but up to 185% of the federal poverty level. That program has a little bit higher federal participation in the funding. The federal government pays approximately 72% of the cost of that program versus the approximately 62% that they pay for regular Medicaid. And that program covers almost 45,000 children. And then we have a small program called the non-OHP Medicaid, and there are several small programs we operate in non-OHP. One of them is a small program called the Breast and Cervical Cancer Program for women with breast and cervical cancer. Another one is a small program that was left over after the elimination of the Medically Needy program in 2003. There were some individuals in that program who had expenses from medications following transplants, and the legislature set up a small program to continue allowing those people to receive their medications. And we have low-income Medicare clients in the non-OHP category. Some individuals who are elderly and low-income qualify for both Medicare and Medicaid. Moving to the benefit packages of the Oregon Health Plan, we have the Oregon Health Plan Plus benefit package, which is the most comprehensive benefit package. Covers a range of physical health, dental health, and mental health services. And most of the clients on the Oregon Health Plan qualify for that OHP Plus benefit package. There's a benefit package called Oregon Health Plan Plus with limited drugs. And that program is for those what we call dual eligibles, people who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. They receive most of their medications through the Medicare program. That's why we say they have limited drugs in the Medicaid program. But they receive medical services through Medicaid.
Colleagues, I'm going to invite you, if you have questions, to feel free, because he's covering a lot of material very quickly. Representative Maurer, you're smiling?
Smiling.
Okay.
Okay, I'm actually almost done, so I'll finish the benefit packages and then answer any questions you might have. The OHP Standard Program benefit package is a more limited benefit package than the OHP Plus benefit package. That program has some scaled-back benefits and a more limited range of services for those individuals who are not qualified for traditional Medicaid, but qualified for what we call our expansion population. There's a small program called QMB, stands for Qualified Medicare Beneficiary. That's a program in which it's actually less expensive for the Oregon Health Plan to pay someone's Medicare premiums and copayments and cost sharing and then allow Medicare to provide those costs than for us to pay for all of those medical services ourselves. So that's a less expensive way to get those services to some elderly people. And then we have a final benefit package called CAWM, which stands for Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medicine. A real mouthful, but that program is for individuals who are not documented citizens. It's a program that's required by the federal government that we have. It provides only emergency care. Emergency care being life-threatening types of care. And also in that definition of emergency care, they include labor and delivery. Not the prenatal care that would go along with that, but just the labor and delivery. And that's for non-documented individuals. So that's a brief overview of what the Oregon Health Plan is. Started in 1994, and we've operated it as a waiver from traditional Medicaid since then, and those are the benefit packages and the programs. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you. On the CAWM, does that provide federal dollars for those services, or are those our state dollars, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, it's the same jointly operated program with federal dollars and state dollars, approximately 62% federal dollars.
62, thank you.
Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, I have two questions, and the first one is about the BCCP, Breast and Cervical Cancer Program. Last year, the administrative cost for that program exceeded 40% of the program, and there was a transition period. And I was wondering, I'm not necessarily expecting you because you may not know the answer, but are we going to have an update on that? Because I would certainly hope. The goal clearly was not to have 40% going forward, but are we going to have an update on how that is progressing, even though that does not use general fund dollars. It's federal and grant money.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, yes, we can get that information for you. That's a program where the eligibility is actually run out of our public health division, and we pay for the medical expenses out of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. But we can get you that information about what the current administrative costs are in that program.
And the next question is on the CAWM, and there's two counties that are in a pilot program, Deschutes and Multnomah, and those are funded, the pilots are funded by the counties, not by the state. But how long will that go, that pilot program go, and are we going to have an opportunity to see the results of the pilot?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, yes, we do operate two pilot projects in the two counties you mentioned, Deschutes and Multnomah, where the counties themselves have put up the local share of funds rather than the state, and a comprehensive benefit package is provided to pregnant women in the CAWM program rather than the limited emergency-only benefit package. And that program was set up for just the current biennium. It is slated to either expire at the end of the biennium or we need to find an administrative way to continue those pilots. I understand there are possibly other counties who might be interested in also having similar pilot programs, and that's something that we'll be talking more with the legislature about during the legislative session.
My understanding is that the reason this program came into being is because when pregnant women aren't provided services, prenatal services, and they come in for delivery, which is required to be provided, then the expense actually can be much greater in babies that are born premature without maternal care during pregnancy. Am I correct in that?
Madam Chair, that's right. Or the other thing that often happens is the obstetricians who provide this care feel compelled to provide the prenatal care, but they do it as charity care rather than getting reimbursed for it.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
To top that one off, is there any effort, study or whatever, to try to capture some of those numbers to prove that this prevention mechanism is working? For example, the number of dollars spent up front in these pilots versus what it would cost without them?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, we don't have those figures yet. Those pilot programs have just operated this biennium, and the biennium still has 5 months left to run. But yes, we will provide you with those that information when we have that.
Representative Cowan and Representative Dimbro.
Thank you. Just a quick question. I missed it in my note taking. Which program is funded via provider tax instead of general fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program.
Okay.
That's the expansion population. It's adults only, and it's individuals who don't qualify for any of the traditional categories of Medicaid, but Oregon chose to cover everyone below 100% of the federal poverty level when we began the Oregon Health Plan as a demonstration project in 1994.
Thank you. I just want to be sure.
Representative Dimbro and then Representative Van Orman, and then we're going to move on.
Great. Thank you. I'm curious about the work of the Health Services Commission. So would they review, for example, the success of those pilot projects in Deschutes County and Multnomah and, you know, in terms of their overall examination of evidence-based care? And actually, I guess a larger question, as we're pursuing health care reform under House Bill 2009, et cetera, has a lot of that work been done by the Health Services Commission, or is their focus really much more limited in terms of what they're looking at?
Madam Chair and Representative Dimbro, their focus is fairly limited. It's their responsibility is to maintain and update that prioritized list, keep it based on current evidence-based medicine and current value to society. They might look at the results of the pilot project, but that wouldn't be something that they would be considered part of their responsibility. Their responsibility is to keep that list up to date. That list is then the original thought behind that list was that then the Health Services Commission would present it to the legislature, which they do every biennium. The legislature would not move things around on the list. That's only the prerogative of the Health Services Commission, but the legislature would get to choose where to draw the line on the number of lines of service we would cover. Unfortunately, the federal government also has to approve any change in the number of lines we cover, and our experience has been the federal government is very reluctant to let us make any change in the number of lines covered, and so we haven't had much luck in using a line movement or line change on the prioritized list as a way of changing expenditures in the Oregon Health Plan, which really was part of the original thought behind the prioritized list.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am one of the new persons here today, and so I'm trying to figure out how this would work for me as a person who needs these care. And so my presumption is that I come to my office at Public Health, and then there's an assignment by the Health Department where I fit for reimbursement of my health expenses. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, not exactly. The Public Health Division is separate from the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. We operate, oversee the Medicaid program, which is a jointly federally and state-funded program for low-income and disabled people. It's not, I mean, we operate a number of things jointly with Public Health Division, but okay. We are basically a health insurance program. Some people call us the second largest insurer in the state after okay. Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. Okay. And we provide health insurance coverage for low-income people.
Okay. I think I'm beginning to understand. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So then back to the COWM. Mm-hmm. Once these children are born, they become ours. They become United States citizens. So then what happens to their coverage? Do they move over to a different category?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, yes, that's exactly right. A child born in the state of Oregon is a U.S. citizen. If they meet the income qualifications, they qualify for the full comprehensive range of services in Medicaid.
Okay. And then I have one more.
The mother may not, but the child does.
Move on.
Okay. And then it would be helpful to see if the poverty level standards, because they change every year. And by my calculation, if you make $8.40 an hour and you're lucky to work a full year, you probably are at the poverty level.
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, the poverty level changes about the 1st of February every year, and it just changed, and so there's a new table out. I don't have that with me, but we can get that for you.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
That would be great. Could you get it to staff, and then we'll pass it around to everybody. Representative Maurer, I know you're on the Health Committee, and is there anybody else in this committee that's on the Health Committee? Good. So I guess I'll depend on the two of you to come back to let us know if there are more issues that we need to be dealing with here. I would assume that some of these issues will be dealt with in the Health Committee. Is that correct?
Well, I think so. There's a lot of overlap.
Yes. There's a lot of overlap.
Right. And if there's something that's not being covered in the Health Committee and we need to cover it here, I would assume that you'll come to me and let me know that. Is that true?
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. But sometimes it's hard to parse out where it belongs.
Oh, I know that. I know. And I think there's some that could belong in both committees. All I'm saying is if it's not being dealt with there, then let's deal with it here. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Thank you, committee. Thank you very much for being willing to come this morning.
You're welcome.
So I close the informational hearing on the Division of Medical Assistance Program and open up the foster care overview. Good morning. Thank you for coming today.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Erin Kelly Seal, and I am the Interim Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. And with me today is
Kevin George. I work as the Foster Care Program Manager at Children, Adults, and Families.
I'm just going to provide a little bit of context for you. We were asked to come and speak generally to really two things. One is the experience of a child who comes into our foster care system, and the second is the experience of a foster parent who serves that child as an out-of-home caregiver. There are many other facets to the work in child welfare. As I mentioned to you last week, the Children, Adults, and Families Division provides a series of supports that meet families' basic needs. Sometimes that means our workers are serving families in a more preventative nature through our self-sufficiency programs. Sometimes it means that we're providing in-home services to families who have come to the attention of our child welfare system because their children are either at risk of harm or have been harmed. And then sometimes it means that we actually do have to remove a child from his or her home and serve that child and their family with the hope of returning the child back to their family in a way such that their parents can be safe and protect them. And when that isn't possible, sometimes that means that we work to find that child a permanent placement as quickly as we possibly can. I just want to give you a quick overview of the handouts that you have, and we'll be kind of tracking a couple of these today and then be happy to provide any additional information that you might want. There's a one page that is entitled Child Welfare Fast Facts for 2007. We're in the process of putting together our report on 2008 data, but this is the data that's currently public. At the bottom of that one pager, and I'll walk you through a couple of the numbers, but at the bottom is a link to the entire report that provides a lot of context for these numbers, which is, of course, very important. And if you're interested in the subject matter, I'd really encourage you to take a look at that. You also have two pieces of paper. One is a project overview, another is a press release that relate to some work I'm going to talk about, our division's effort to safely reduce the number of children in foster care. I referenced this last week, and I have some follow-up for Representative Cowan when we get to that portion of the report on our work around disproportionality and cultural competency. You also, I skipped something, I'm sorry, and I just didn't bring my copy because this is the portion Kevin's going to walk you through. We, last session, Senate Bill 13 passed requiring us to come back to the legislature and provide some specific information about the experience children are having in foster care as it relates to placement stability and placement with siblings, and Kevin's going to talk you through that data and information. And then we're going to spend a little bit of time, and we provided you with a letter that just gives a quick overview of some of the current supports that we provide to foster parents who volunteer themselves to provide temporary supports for children who cannot be safely at home with their parents. Sometimes foster parents actually are related to the children, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So those are the handouts that you have, and I'll just start quickly with a little bit of information about who we serve and how that looks. I mentioned last week when we were giving the overview that we receive all of the calls in the state that report child abuse and neglect, and in 2007 there were over 63,000 calls. We went out and investigated, based on the information provided in those calls, over 26,380 reports. And we confirmed that over 10,700 children in Oregon were victims of abuse and neglect. By far the most significant issue facing children and their families who come into contact with the child welfare system is drug and alcohol addiction, and there was some very rich discussion of that at last Wednesday's hearing in this committee, which I really appreciated. When it comes to our priorities, if we are able to safely keep a child at home with their parents, that, of course, is something that we would like to be able to do. Unfortunately, I know this is not the budget committee, but only a very small percent of the resource that our division is provided is dedicated to what we call in-home service delivery, and that's because the federal priority, which really created and started and drives a lot of the funding for our child welfare program, is on out-of-home care, out-of-home placements. So we've been working very hard to maximize the resource that is invested in our system so that we can invest in keeping children home safely with their families. And part of the TANF redesign that your committee, Chair Tomei, was a part of in 2007 included some additional resource for what we call the Family Support and Connections Program. And even though that program is technically not a child welfare program, it is very much a child abuse prevention program because it allows our self-sufficiency staff to identify families that may be at risk of coming into the child welfare system and divert them to an in-home support program to try and, before that family becomes a report in our child welfare system, make that family whole and improve the protective capacity of the parent. And so that's an incredible program from our perspective that we really value. There are other programs as well that we know do a very good job of supporting families in their home that the legislature also invests in but that are not administered by our agency, particularly for young children. And some of those programs are at the Commission on Children and Families, the Healthy Start Program. Crisis Relief Nurseries actually do provide a very early intervention for many of the families that come into contact with child welfare. And the Head Start, Early Head Start programs also do some amazing work with families and their family advocates to keep families and keep them together. So although the investment in child welfare specifically, once a family becomes known to us and a report of abuse is founded, is relatively small, there are a lot of community supports. Not enough, I think we would like to say, but there are others than just our agencies responsible for that I think it's important that you be aware of. If we cannot keep a child safe in their own home, we then must make the decision to bring them into out-of-home care. And there are different kinds of out-of-home care. Kevin can give you a quick overview probably and better than I can. But let me just give you some statistics about the number of children for whom that was an experience last year. Over 15,000 children had a foster care experience last year. That means they spent at least one day in foster care. And on any given month, there are between around 9,000 and 9,300 children who are living in what the federal government defines as foster care, and that's a very broad definition. Sometimes that can mean that we actually have legal custody of the child, the state does, but they've been returned home to their family, and so we are legally responsible and their custodian, but they have been returned home after having been in an out-of-home placement, and that counts in the state as foster care. The foster care that most of us think of, though, is foster care that's being provided by someone other than the child's parent and maybe not in a residential treatment setting, and there are over 7,000 children who are being served in those family foster care environments. So either by someone that they know or someone who's related to them, or maybe someone that they don't know, but they're living in a home with a family. One of the issues that we'll talk about a little bit later is the fact that we know that there is an overrepresentation of Native American and African American children in our foster care system. We've been talking most recently and using the term disproportionality. That refers either to an over or under representation of a community of color in our system. So for some communities, it could mean that we're not serving them enough, that we're not, our services are such that we're not responding appropriately to those families, we're not serving them enough. And for others, it can, and in the case of African Americans and Native Americans, their proportion in our foster care system, the proportionate number of children who fall into those two racial and ethnic groups, is actually greater than their proportion in the overall population of Oregon. So for instance, for African American children, they represent about 3.6% of the population of Oregon children overall. But in our foster care system, they represent 6.5% of our foster care population. And in the case of Native American children, and these are individuals who self-identify as Native American, these are not necessarily individuals who qualify for the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is a federal law that is a mandate to states to serve children who are eligible for enrollment or are enrolled in a federally recognized tribe in a specific way. So we have to provide active efforts, not just reasonable efforts, for those families according to the federal law. That's the Indian Child Welfare Act. But when we talk about the overrepresentation of Native American children, we're actually talking about families and children who self-identify culturally as Native American. And when you look at the overall population of Native Americans in Oregon, they represent about 1.4% of the population, but in foster care, 8.3%. So when you hear us talk about overrepresentation of children in color, that's the issue that we are, those are the two population groups we are very focused on right now, but we're also focused generally on the issue of disparities. And again, Representative Callen last week had asked for some additional information that we'll provide a little bit later on about what it means to try and adjust our policy and practice to the values and the culture of a family and how that looks for us in real time. I think it's also really important to know what happens to children who are leaving our foster care system. So in 2007, 64% of the children who came into care, the children who were leaving care, so that isn't 64% of that broader 9,000 number, but it's 64% of children leaving care, went home to their families. And I think that's a number that often gets overlooked. There's a lot of focus, and rightly so, on adoption services, and 18% of children leaving foster care were adopted. But I think, again, our capacity to serve those families that are being reunited is much less than our capacity to serve other families, such as adoptive or guardianship placements. And so I just think it's an important dichotomy to raise from a policy perspective around the supports that we provide to parents and their children in our system. About 6% of children went into some form of guardianship. I mentioned already 18% were adopted. And there were about 6% who were emancipated, and Kevin's going to talk a little bit about what it looks like for children who are older, who are unfortunately aging out of our foster care system. And you can imagine what it might feel like to be 18 years old and not have family or connection resources, and it's our obligation to try and make sure that that doesn't happen, that we can connect a young person who is leaving the foster care system with those kinds of supports and make sure that there's a plan for them in place. So that gives you just a brief overview of what happens when children leave. 64% go home, 18% adopted, 6% in guardianship, 6% emancipated. And there's another 6%, some of which we think we're not capturing the data very accurately, and we're trying to make improvements on that. And some of whom, I know this committee's also spent some time looking at runaway and homeless youth, unfortunately end up not in our system and really not accounted for. And that's something we're also working to do better with. So that's a quick overview of just statistically what our general program represents when it comes from the comes to children and their families. And I'm going to turn it over to Kevin to talk a little bit more about the foster care experience and some of the efforts that we're making to keep kids safe in foster care and also improve the stability of their placements and improve their family connections.
Thank you, Erin. I'm going to ask folks to hold on to their questions, if you don't mind, until after Kevin is through. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Again, Kevin George, I work as the Foster Care Program Manager at the Department of Human Services. What I'm going to do is spend a few minutes walking through the one report that is should be with you, and it's titled Child Welfare Report to the Legislature Across the Top, Chapter 238. And this is a result of Senate Bill 413 from last session, where Senators Brown and Cruz and Representative Krieger and Schaffler co-sponsored a number of child welfare legislation, this being one of them, with the interest in being that we would start providing data to the interim legislative committees prior to sessions around placement stability. And that was a big concern around hearing the number of kids moving and how often the children in foster care are moving and whatnot. And so that was really the impetus behind this. And there's a number of data elements that you'll find in the report, and I'm going to walk you through what these are without going into reading every line by line, but at least try to hit some of the highlights for you. And again, as Erin talked about for a moment, when we talk about foster care, at this point in time, for this report, I'm talking about foster care in a very broad sense, the federal definition. So that is all the children who have come into our care from Child Protective Services, and they're living in a family foster home. They may be living with their relatives. They may be living in a residential program, and some of those children have been in foster care, have been returned home, and we still have legal custody. So it's a very broad definition of that. And although I'm not a strong proponent of that definition, that is what the federal government defines, and it's been important for us to stay in alignment with what they've got as far as definitions. So I will try to break down when I'm talking about family foster care being a little bit different than all the foster care numbers. But right now, as you see on page one, really what we're going to go through is some of the successes and certainly some of the challenges, area of concern, some of the actions we've been taking around placement stability, because this has been on our radar for some time around children's experience within our system. So when we're looking at the number of kids who have had placements, 30% or 29.4% of them have only had one placement. The other 70% have had more than one placement. And that, again, that counts for all 15,000 of those children that Erin spoke to earlier. Federal government, when they do a federal review of our program, so they're coming out about every 3 years now and doing what's called the Children and Family Services Review. And when they evaluated us in 2001, it was that we were right on the national average around placement stability, and that was for looking at two placements. The federal government, as well as all of child welfare, quite frankly, in this country, is getting a lot better about data and trying to do a better job of understanding it, really moving towards evidence-based practice. And doing so, it is not looking at just what is that number of two placements, but let's start breaking it down and to say, of those children who came in their first year, how many children had more than one placement? in their second year, third year, how those children have been in care for a very long time, what is their experience in care? So you're not just focusing on that very front-end child only, but really looking at those children who have been in care as well. And so in Oregon, we have, we're under, if you move to the second page, you'll see that we're under the national median for the children the first 12 months of care. We're above the national median for those children who spent 12 months to 24 months. And then we are below the national, we're still above the national median on the children who've had care for 24 months or more. And that's a group that, as Aaron mentioned a little bit earlier, that's really those longer-term children who've been in our care, some of them the older teens, and we need to really start talking and focusing about how we're going to really serve that population. Again, the placement stability issue is a challenge in trying to meet, it's one thing to meet numbers, it's a whole other thing to meet what's in the best interest of a child. And so I, each and every time, working with the federal government, if they're going to come and review us and say, Mr. George, why did this child have two placements? And the description is that the child had an emergency placement with a foster parent today. We found an aunt tomorrow, and we moved the child to aunt. That's two placements for that child. I will continue to say that's in the best interest of this child and continue to work towards that, even though our numbers may not be better if we just kept the child in the same foster home. So it's not about chasing the numbers, from my opinion, for the federal government. It is about what's in the best interest of the children. So some of our placements have really been short-term. A prime example here for many people that know the Marion County system is that we have community homes. And through Catholic Community Services and a variety of other folks have worked together to create a community home so a child can stay in their same neighborhood and the same school and not have to then move into just any foster home. That is a wonderful place for those children, but again, we find relatives the next day, and that's where they go. But that's still in the best interest of the children. So some of these placement moves are a result of that. But it's not to say, though, that children are not moving in our system and moving in our system too much. We need to be very clear that part of the efforts around looking at our behavior rehabilitation services, which is our system that we have for residential treatment for children, we did a redesign of that last biennium and trying to really say what is the real need of some of these children, because when we go into looking at how many placements some of the children have had, is it 20, is it 30, why is it so many times? And what we started discovering and finding is that some of these children are moved from foster home to foster home to foster home, all knowing that what we need is a residential treatment service for this child. It needs a higher level of care. And so we can't keep moving around trying to get to that higher level of care, but we need to go to that higher level of care now. So through the redesign of family or the behavior rehabilitation services, it was to try to focus in on what is the real need of some of these children. And so there's some new services that we've been able to put into place this year, and hopefully we'll start seeing some of our numbers change. When you get to the page 3, it really is a long table, and this is, again, all the children have been in the system and what was their experience. When you get down into the numbers of 70, 40, 30, those kind of numbers, what we did is also went in to start pulling out the data on that, saying, okay, tell me who Johnny is. Who moved 70 times and why? Why did this one move 60? And what we also discovered is our system has limitations in a program for family foster care, which is we don't have a formal program for respite care for families. And so what we've done and what some of our branches have done is tried to make things work. So if the child is with the Joneses this week and the Joneses need a break, they need respite care for the weekend. They need a weekend off. Little Johnny will move to the Johnsons. And what happens then is we have, in order to make that placement occur so we know where the child is at all times and payments, we will close out the Joneses foster home, open up the Johnsons. Little Johnny goes back with the foster parent on Monday or Sunday night. We close that one and open up at the Johnsons again. So in essence, you had three placements over one weekend when really that was just the system limitations we have. So we've been trying to work with our data folks to say we've got to come up with another way to do this because that's not a placement move. That is respite. And so really identifying that as a service and not as a placement. So there's some work to be done on that still. But that was when I started really going through and had my staff say, tell me who's 70, who's 63, who's 64. I want names of children. I want names of placements. And that's what we really discovered is that some of this was data errors. But it's not to say we still have a lot of work to do in placement stability for children. I then move us on to the, page 4, and this starts talking about placement connections. And again, the importance of really focusing in on, we've been through a number of legislative sessions where we have continued to hone in on what is important. And so for, you know, one session we're here really focusing in on children needing to stay in their same neighborhoods, and it's important to have same neighborhoods. And so if a child has to be in foster care, there's really an important reason for them still to stay in that same neighborhood if it's safe. So they still see, you know, the dog down the street. They still see the neighbors. They can stay in their same school. And there's been a lot of work in the past sessions around keeping children in the same school and communities, as well as being able to be placed with relatives if at all possible. And so really focusing in on those pieces of this has been really important. And so when you look at the one graph there, it really splits out all the different types of placements where children have been. I then move on to trying to hone in on really the question that most people really ask is, say, Kevin, okay, I hear the numbers about foster care, 15,000, 9,000. Which ones are those that I think of when I say foster care? Which ones are those family foster care? So the children are living with the Joneses down the street or the Johnsons. That really is that 7,000 number that Aaron spoke to. And we're talking at this point in time around 26% of all of those children in a family setting are actually living with a relative. And those relatives then are identified, found, we search for them, we ask folks about them. They are then trained, they are certified, and they have to follow all the same licensing regulations that a non-related foster parent has too. And so that's a piece that has been in place. We need to continue to move, and Aaron will speak in a few minutes about one of the initiatives really focusing in on relative placements. And that is certainly the direction that many states have gone to really talk about how do you reduce the numbers of children in care, how do you do cost savings, all along the line of being best interest of the children. And so relative care is certainly the direction. The next category is sibling relationships. And this was an area that was of special interest last session to folks. And it was around, so if children have to come into care, can you keep them all together? So if two children come into care, why is it that they can't be together, or three children or four children? And what I'll say is that we have really tried hard over the last several years to really focus in on that sibling placement. And again, it is that call, and I've had those calls to foster parents before saying, can you take four children? And they say, that's a lot of kids at one time, but nevertheless, that's relative placement. So we have had situations where at times there's six children in a sibling group or seven or eight children in a sibling group, and we need to place all of them at one time. So really focusing in on this, I had the experience here in the last year where, again, Marion County was trying to focus in on their siblings' placements and wanted to do some work around that. And Community Partners brought in a gentleman from back east to really talk about a sibling program that they had in I think it was in Georgia. And they do specific sibling placements. That's the only placements they'll do is sibling work. And we started getting real excited about it and listening to it. But then when we started talking about numbers, in Oregon now, 80% of the children are with at least one sibling. That's better than that specialized program back east. And it was about a value base to say, keeping kids in their neighborhoods, keeping them with relatives. Relatives are more likely to take sibling groups than non-relatives are. How do you hone in on those? So we don't necessarily need another agency from another state to come in and parachute in here to show us our work. We know this work now, and we really know the value of sibling connections. And so even if Johnny and Susie can't live in the same home for a variety of reasons, they still have the need and the desire and the right to be connected by having visits, by having phone calls, by exchanging emails, Facebook, whatever it is. They need to stay connected all along the line while they're in care. And our family decision meetings is one of the real critical strategies on how you find those relatives and how do you find people that will actually be able to work together with sibling groups so you can bring both foster parents in if you need to, and they'll talk about how do we exchange information. And you do a visit with them on Monday, I'll do a visit with them on Thursday, and keep those connections together. So sibling connections really is a very critical piece. And I've been with foster youth a number of times over the last several years, and hopefully we'll continue to be there. And one of the things that they often talk about is, it was very traumatic for me to come into foster care. It was very traumatic for me to move from a home to another home or a new school. But the key commonality that they all talk about is, I lost my siblings. I wanted to have contact with my siblings. So that's one of those strategies that we can do something about that. And so,
Madam Chair,
I would, With that, then really, the last piece I would say is on that older group of young people, we have that those children, and some of our numbers about the numbers of placements and length of care are really attributed to there are some children in our system who have been growing up in foster care. And as other folks have talked about, the state is not a permanent parent. The state should not be a permanent parent. We need to find placements for these children. Regardless, some of these children have been growing up in care and have been with us 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, and now they're approaching 17, 18, 19, 20, and it's time for them to move on. And it's time where they are exiting our system, and we are charged with trying to figure out ways of starting to work with young people at 16 around. What is their plan for housing? What is their plan for education? What is their plan for employment? What is their health care plan, both their physical and their mental health needs? And mostly, what is their plan for community connections? Who are they connected to? Who are they going to be able to call when they need help? Who's, and one of the things when I work with youth, I always say, when they, you know, at 18, 19, sometimes you have that, I don't need anybody attitude. And it's one of those to say, who are you going to put down on your job application when it says emergency contact number? And that just really stops them in their track to say, wait a sec, yes, that is a requirement. You have to put down emergency contact. We all do that in all of our offices. So who do you put down? And when those kids can't name that, then we say, we need to back up and find out who that's going to be. And so there's a variety of strategies, and there's a new form group called the Oregon Foster Youth Connection. And it's former foster youth and current foster youth who have really come together to really start putting together a united voice for Oregon's children and what is it that they actually need to do. So I know they're going to be over here in a couple of weeks, and there's some emphasis that is going to continue to grow around that. But one of the greatest things that through a partnership with certainly the legislature, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Department, and the federal government around really looking at higher education. These kids need to have the same bar set as anybody else's children. College is an option for these kids now. Now, they don't get everything paid for, but they certainly have some scholarship opportunities, and I'm really pleased to continue to say we continue to have more kids applying each and every year to the point where we're having budget problems. We have to start reducing amounts. That's a good problem. We can talk about how to get more budget, but it's a good problem to have more kids stepping up. And so there's about 230 current or former foster youth in higher education today. 60% of them are in community colleges, which is a great option for some of these young people. So some of them are living in a foster home still. Some of them are at U of O and everywhere else. So that's a very good direction we're going to continue to move in as to that is a step for these kids like any other children out there. So with that, I think I'll stop and turn it over to Erin.
I'm just going to sum up with a couple of just really critical objectives that we're setting for ourselves in the program, and then I know you have questions, and then we, if we have time, we'll get to the foster parent perspective as well. But I just want to say that I really need to acknowledge the incredible responsibility that our division has in the lives of these children and their families, and I'm very proud to be associated with the staff that does this work under incredibly challenging and increasingly complex circumstances every day. I know sometimes what the stories that are in the headlines can sometimes, I think, be misrepresentative of what's happening in the majority of the experience of our system. And I think it's really important, and I really appreciate and want to thank the chair for giving us some time to give you that whole picture. It's not to say that we don't have some extraordinary challenges that we need to rise to, but I think that it's incredibly humbling, and the work that is being done by a staff that is, by all accounts, incredibly understaffed to the tune of 25% to 35% is pretty remarkable when you look at the kinds of outcomes that we're really trying to achieve for these children and their families. So with that, what I want to say is that our system has undertaken a look at, well, what could we do better to serve children and their families? And this isn't about saving money, and it's not about shoring up our workload challenges, although those are very real for us. But what this is really about is how can we serve the children and families that we come into contact with better. And there is research across the country and growing movement and awareness of the fact that spending life in foster care is not always a positive experience for anyone, and that it really needs to be our responsibility to try and minimize the experience of foster care for children and their families as much as we possibly can. At the same time, uphold our incredible responsibility to keep children who become known to our system safe. And that overall issue of safety has to be the driving factor for us in every single thing that we do. So we can't, at the expense of knowing that foster care may not be the most positive experience for a child, leave a child in an unsafe home environment. That's not an option for us. So I want you to know that one of the things we're trying to do is really safely reduce the number of children who experience foster care in this state. We know that Oregon brings more children into foster care than many states nationally. And we're really trying to drill down as to why that is. Why are our rates higher? And to that end, we've set some goals for ourselves around that safe reduction effort, and we're very fortunate to have the Commission on Children and Families partnering with us in this. They do incredible work mobilizing communities around our strategies to say, how can we support the Child Welfare Division in this effort as they try and do this work? And we're very fortunate to have other partners like the Judicial Branch at the table with us, as well as attorneys, CASA, Citizen Review Board, which are comprised of volunteers, as well as a lot of nonprofit and other organizations that are working with us on this, and a national foundation, KC Family Programs, has brought us some very catalytic resource, not a lot in the grand scheme of our budget, but some catalytic resource to bear, which is allowing us for some to have some additional technical assistance and training around what are the best practices nationally as we undergo this effort to safely reduce the number of kids in care. And what that looks like is fewer kids coming in the door, kids who have been in care for longer periods of time getting out more quickly. It looks like us following the policy direction from the legislature last session to improve and increase the number of placements we make with relatives or people who are known to children. And it also looks like us reducing the effect of disparities on communities of color that are touched by our system or who come into contact with our system. And I want to respond directly also to Representative Cowan's question last Wednesday, which we committed to following up on. What does it look like for child welfare to acknowledge or honor the values of a family? How do we do that in a culturally specific way or in a family specific way? And Kevin and I each have two examples. One that I have is about a Somali family in which we were receiving reports that there was a 14-year-old girl who was being left for extended periods of time to be the caregiver for very young children. And we went and spoke with the family and the parents about the fact that that wasn't appropriate, that the 14-year-old daughter needed to also be able to be a child herself, and that really we needed that practice to discontinue. It continued. We got reports again, and some of our staff started talking about strategies like parenting classes and ways that they would want to educate the Somali woman about how to try other approaches and not have her 14-year-old daughter be the caregiver for extended periods of time for very, very young children. We brought in some experts in African culture and talked with them about what was maybe going on from the perspective of the family, and we learned that in Somalia, 14-year-old girls are at the age of marriage, and that it would actually be bad parenting for this mother not to be training her daughter to be the head of household and to be the caregiver for children. And so in the eyes of this mother, she was actually doing the responsible thing as a parent and really was having a hard time understanding our cultural value that would say, actually, this is irresponsible of you as a parent. So we made adjustments in our plan working with that family to accommodate the cultural perspective from which that family came. Another family that I was working closely with on some mental health issues was a family that really did not believe in psychotropic medications, but their child had very significant behavioral health issues. And they were increasingly frustrated with the fact that our system was telling them that we needed their child to be on a particular psychotropic medication. We problem-solved with the family and were able to come to an approach whereby that the family agreed that if we had to do that as a last resort, they would be okay with that. We agreed that we would try other strategies like nutritional adjustment, exercise, and other non-medical interventions, interventions that didn't involve medication first, before we went to the extraordinary step. And we had to get the foster parent on board with that, as well as several others. But it was our effort to accommodate the value of that family for them, which meant we would really prefer not to have our child on a psychotropic medication. So, Kevin, do you want to also provide a couple other concrete examples?
Sure, certainly. And I think the the piece to get a flavor for is that when we're talking about cultural needs, cultural specific services, it really is a wide range. So one of the areas that we've really worked on this last biennium as well is on education needs for children, and that we've had communities that really believe part of their culture is that homeschooling. Homeschooling is important for some families, both families that children come into protective services and for some of our foster families. And so really through some of the policy work we've done, we really put into place in there that homeschool is an option for our foster children, but it first must be checked with the courts. We must have the CASAs involved, the attorneys for children, the biological family and or the foster family to make sure that it's a consistent plan for everybody, and so it's not being forced on one person or another. But it is trying to say you have a value or a culture desire of homeschooling, and we can honor that at times as well. We also have had another situation, which I'm really pleased about the continued work that they've done, because it continues to grow larger and larger, is that there's a program up in the Portland area called the Native American Youth and Family Association. And we've been working with them off and on for a number of years. And really some of it was talking about when I started looking at our independent living program for teenagers, and that's helping transition those young people out, was that a very high number of children were not Native American, yet that's a very high percentage in our system, as Aaron talked about. And so I really started talking with folks to say, why is that? Well, it was that we weren't providing culturally specific service. So we entered into a contract with Native American Youth and Family Association, said, teach us something different. So instead of having structured classes like some of our programs, they'll do what they'll call is talking circles and be able to work with young people that way. They're able to help these young people actually re-engage with tribal communities if that's indeed what's been important to them, and that may be what's been missing for them for a long time, having that connection. And then it's actually grown into really starting to work with some of our foster parents and providing them training, or with the biological parents and providing them training so they can do the training classes together, a foster parent and a biological parent, on how to do some parenting. And it's, the program's called Positive Indian Parenting, but it's just another way of approaching the same outcome in a different approach. So that was the two examples that I would add.
I think it probably best that we stop, but I also want to just say that there are some efforts we are very committed to that hopefully we may have a few minutes to speak to around keeping children safer in care, as well as improving some of the mental health outcomes for children in care. And during the interim, for those of you that served on the committee, you heard us speak to some of our efforts around mental health for children and youth who are in foster care. And we also appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of the challenges and opportunities that we have working with foster parents across the state. So maybe we'll pause and take some questions.
Great. Thank you so much. Representative Boone, I know you had a question.
I do. I actually have three. I guess I'll start with the one that when we first started hearing informational hearings in this committee, we heard a number of statistics about kids in foster care and how it was related to parents or parents in jail or with drug and alcohol and mental health issues. So I'm wondering, it seemed kind of obvious to me that if you start treating the drug and alcohol and the mental health issues, you might find the number of children in foster care falling off. And so I'm wondering what's being done around that. The 800-pound elephant in the room is the number percentage of the cuts in these services, and I guess I'm wondering how you plan to address it with those cuts in mind.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, thank you for that question. It is a critical issue for us. About 64% of children who enter foster care have one or more parent who is drug or alcohol addicted, and it's about 55% of kids that for whom reports of abuse or neglect come through for whom this is an issue. Last legislative session, we were very fortunate the legislature saw fit to dedicate over $10 million of addiction treatment money to parents of children who were involved in the child welfare system. And this was really unprecedented. The way that this state budgets for addiction treatment historically either has been through community providers through the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid program, which Jim Edge just spoke about, or directly with a general fund investment in counties, and counties then make the decision about how to prioritize those services and have done a very good job doing so. But I think what was helpful this last session, and I think if Gina Nickel were sitting next to me, she would agree, was that counties were given additional resource to really target this population before they were forced into the criminal justice system, but really when they came into contact with child welfare and we had identified the drug or alcohol addiction was an issue for them. So over the biennium, I just have a few of the outcomes so far that we've seen, but around 480 parents have enrolled in treatment services, outpatient and residential combined, and 75% of those parents who began accessing those services are still enrolled, which is incredible. I mean, one of the ways that we measure success of treatment program is continued enrollment over a period of time. We feel like we're having really great success. The treatment gap for parents has closed significantly. In 2005, and I can get the numbers for you because I don't have them right this moment, but in 2005, the gap between, for our parents coming into the system and their ability, in other words, their ability to access treatment was very significant. We had lost so much capacity and we had almost no resource dedicated to addiction treatment that our parents could access. Now that gap has closed, and what this investment did was give general fund for those families who are not OHP eligible, and that's a pretty significant number of them. We had some testimony in which I heard about a family who had actually been successful. They've met all of the reunification criteria that the state had set, and they'd also been able to secure housing, which was a requirement that Child Welfare Division had set for them to return their children home to them. And the housing was being supplemented, paid for by this general fund investment that the legislature made for a short period of time, not forever, while this person got on their feet, employed, and was sober. And what that had allowed was for this parent to actually bring her children home, and she had had them home for the last 9 months and had been sober the entire time. So it's incredibly critical to us to maintain as much investment as possible. And those targeted treatment dollars were very, very important to our system.
I'll cut it back to the two. Kevin, I think you mentioned runaway and homeless youth population, and I'm just wondering if there is money in the governor's budget for that, if data is being kept, and especially as these kids are termed out or whatever you call it from foster care, and it sounds like there is some effort to connect them with other services, et cetera, but I'm just wondering, is there a, I know that there's a, I've been active in the group, Runaway and Homeless Youth, and the programs that they have been successful in giving their services to these kids, but is that is that going to be continued? And I know they're asking for some money this time. Has there been any effort to include them in this, in these expenditures?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, what I can share with you a little bit is I, too, am on some of those committees of homeless and runaway youth coalitions, and there was money allocated last legislature that went to the Commission on Children and Families, and what occurred with that was, and obviously Mickey Lansing would be able to speak a lot better than this than I can about it, but it was, there was a pilot site, so I believe it was 8 different pilot sites that got the funding divvied up at different initiatives, and the commission did a very nice job of bringing forward a very, very wide range of diverse opinions on the grants, mine being one of them, about how they should be funded and who should get the funding for it. And it was everything from street outreach to day services where kids, young people can hang out. You know, one of the things we talk about frequently about the homeless runaway youth is that youth in that world oftentimes is defined by age almost up until 24. And so a lot of youth programs, youth serving programs, or young adult serving programs are starting to really see the gap is really from about 16-year-olds to about 24. And that's really where a lot of these young people are existing. And so certainly our efforts at the department are much more around really looking at further upstream, how do you prevent the run in the first place? Doing some work with the New Avenues for Youth program in downtown Portland, and that's exactly what we've been talking about, is how do we develop some projects or some strategies, more so than waiting for a big grant to fall under the sky, and have used the Child Welfare Partnership with Catherine Kahn to really start talking about best practices on how do you intervene with some of those young people early on, because there's new studies or new information coming out to say it's really our system continues to do the chase the 17, 18-year-old, and how do you take care of the housing needs today, which is very necessary. But how do you stop the flood of those kids getting there? So when research starts coming out and starts telling me when are the kids likely to run, a 13 or 14-year-old, it's really not the 17-year-old, it's a different strategy you employ. Who's likely to run, girls more than boys? Why is that? You know, are they running from something? Are they running to something? Are they running just to be running? And all those things play into what strategy you employ at a different point. So that's some of the work we're trying to do, is to say, we don't have all that information, but some of our community partners clearly do, and other people in the community, as well as bringing in youth. Why are you running? What is going on? And how do we stop this from occurring again?
Thank you. And we will be having the Commission for Children and Families come in to present to us. Thank you so much. Representative Olson and then Representative Cowan.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Kevin, this question gets back to you because you were talking about the siblings issue initially. I'm curious, what is the percentage of the homes or during the cases that you're not able to tie the siblings into a foster home? Or actually, maybe you might be able to just, that doesn't happen very often or whatever, rather than break it down to a percentage.
Yeah, what we have is of children who actually are in foster care that are not placed with at least one other sibling, is 19, or just about 20%. So, again, the sibling connection piece around saying 80% of our children are placed together are at least with one other sibling. So if there's a sibling group of four, you know, two went here and two went there, that's how that number is calculated. If it's just a sibling group of two and kids went to two different homes, then that would be the 20%. Is that... Did I get your question correct, or?
I think, yeah.
Okay.
You're there.
Okay.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, if I may just add one comment for some context. It probably wouldn't be appropriate for our number to be 100%. In some cases, siblings are not safe together. And I heard a story recently of an older foster youth, incredible young woman, who had been sexually abused by her brother really her whole life. Her mother had not protected her from her brother, and she had recently come into our care at the age of 16 and was incredibly grateful and felt safe for the first time. It would not have been appropriate for us to put her in a foster placement with her brother.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up. Well, Aaron, you've mentioned that I was in the back of my mind from previous life, but to get back then, maybe for both of you, I know, I mean, we had this discussion down at the courthouse last week regarding foster homes and placements with Judge I think it was Haller, wasn't it?
Waller, Judge Dan Waller.
Right, from Multnomah County. Mm-hmm. But what I was concerned about was the issue of, I'm recalling back years ago for placement of children in foster homes, there didn't appear to be as many homes available for multiple children, especially like the siblings, you know, where it is nice to be able to keep them together and everything. How's that moving forward today?
Yeah. Certainly, Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, that continues to be a struggle. It is absolutely, you know, ideally we've talked a lot about can we recruit specific homes in that will only take siblings, and you put them on the second list. They're not the list that takes in any child, but we wait for them for the home that can take in three kids. You know, ideally that would be a wonderful way to do that. We've tried, but quite frankly, just the number of kids and the lack of resources with foster homes, it just precludes us from really being able to set aside some families. Clearly, though, we do have foster parents that do step forward and say, you know, I only want, you know, little kids, or I only want teenagers, and I can take in, you know, two boys. You know, if you have brothers that come in, those kind of placements do occur. You know, some of our challenge is both in increasing our training for foster parents to really understand that they know how to work with youth when they come into care, sibling groups, because, you know, it's one of those things where folks talk about, well, they shouldn't be together because they always fight. Well, you know what? I have five brothers. We always fought, too. But that was okay. That's part of sibling bond, sibling relationship. So part of it is training our caseworkers, training our foster parents to understand how do you work with sibling groups when there is behavior issues. Some of the other strategies is also talking about for those kids that can't be together, either because of resources or because of their own individual needs. There's another program that got started here by some Oregonians in the last 3 or 4 years, I think it's running now, called Camp To Belong. And it's a national program that we have a Northwest site. This summer they're going to actually have two camps where we can actually send our foster kids who are not placed together to go and spend a week together and do sibling stuff. So they do a birthday party, they hang out all week long, they have camp counselors that are with them, and so they really spend that enrichment time with them and keep those connections together as much as possible. So that's really targeted for those kids that are not together, but a strategy, how can you keep them together with limited resources?
Yeah, I just want to make one comment. Let's be quick.
Okay.
I greatly appreciate what you do from a foster perspective, I mean from what you do, because it is so nice to be able to have a facility that you feel comfortable with. You've kind of gotten to know the foster parents to be able to place, you know, a child there, and just especially pulling them out of a situation is pretty ugly. So, thanks.
And you have experience in that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a sad situation that we need desperately the foster homes that we do need, and I greatly respect individuals who are willing to provide foster care. What would be interesting to me to have is sort of a compilation of some numbers that you could get back to us with at some point. In terms of the foster homes that you have available in your perspective, some percentages on what number of those are what I would consider the traditional family home with a couple of kids that's willing to take in another child or two into kind of a traditional family setting, for lack of a better way to describe it, and the number that are running almost as a business taking in a group. I don't know what the maximum number is. I know in adult foster care it's 5, so I don't know what it is for children, but I assume there's a top number. And I know I've talked to some school districts who have a number of families for whom that is kind of a business. And so then the secondary question to that is what the level of assistance is that we provide to foster parents. I know it varies according to age, but there surely are some compilation of numbers, and also the funding that follows in an adoption. What sort of subsidy do adoptive parents get as they move through that system? I'm really curious about some of those numbers.
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, we'd be happy to get you a breakdown more specifically numerically. And what you have in that letter is some text that describes both the direct supports that we offer to foster parents, inclusive of reimbursement. It doesn't go into the detail I think you're asking us to provide you, but it talks about training, reimbursement, parent support groups, and then several indirect kinds of support that foster parents also receive. But I will say, because it's looking very much like we probably won't get to spend too much time on this, which is perfectly okay. I know you all can read what we provided you. We don't do enough to support foster parents in this state. We know that. We would like to be able to do more. We are currently in the process of redesigning our reimbursement structure for foster parents to make it more fair, consistent, and be transparent. But we are not able in that redesign to address the issue of adequacy. I was just going to quickly search for a number, which I know is on top of, oh, here it is, Kevin's head, but in a study done in 2007 called Hitting the Mark that reviewed the true cost to raise a child and what states reimburse foster parents for that effort, Oregon ranked in the bottom 25% in the country in terms of our reimbursement to foster care and out-of-home caregivers. One of the positive things I just want to congratulate the legislature on, however, is that in 07, for the first time, Oregon implemented a policy in which we actually reimburse relatives to provide foster care to their children. Before now, that was not a benefit relatives received, and it was actually a disincentive for many relatives who work and were going to need to actually pay child care or after school care to receive
a child in their home as a relative, they had nothing, no additional financial support with which to accommodate that, let alone shoes, food, the kinds of things. I have two children. I know this firsthand, diapers that really do add up when you're trying to raise a child. And so we are grateful to the legislature for implementing that policy change because it's allowing us to advance the policy direction also set by the legislature to improve relative placements and connections for foster youth. So I want to say that we know we don't do enough for our foster parents, and we would very much like, one of our efforts as part of the redesign is to be able to clearly articulate what the gap is between where we are and where we would really like to be, not to put people on the spot and say we're doing horribly. We already know we could be doing better, and the national report makes that very clear, but instead to be able to say these are the kinds of things that when additional resource becomes available for this kind of policy work, we would like to be able to do.
Chair Tomain, Representative Cowan, the only other thing I would add to that is, because I never miss an opportunity to say this, is that at the end of the day, though, the average foster parent is getting $15 a day. And I have three kids. I have two boys, and they eat that much by lunch every day. It's $15 a day on average for a foster parent.
Thank you. And I did find that in the letter that I hadn't read yet, but I would just like the rest
of we'll get you some additional numbers, Representative.
Great. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. On the aging out group, we have in Hood River County a new adventure called Wings that is providing some housing and experiences for children. And I should know this answer, but I don't. Is the state providing any assistance to those children for that program?
Representative Van Orman, I actually have on my schedule a call to Allison, and her last name
Pate.
Is escaping me.
Pate.
To discuss the WINGS program. I don't know, but I do know that we actually do not invest any general fund in this state in what we call our independent living program, which is fully federally funded and serves only about, Kevin, help me out here, what percentage of foster youth?
About a third of the children who actually are eligible receive services through the independent living program.
So we do have some federal resource in Oregon, and we know that it is only serving about one-third of the young people who are old enough and eligible to receive it. I can find out the answer when I talk with Allison about whether her program receives any of that federal contribution. And
I don't think so, but I don't know.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Oh, Michael.
Yes, sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to disproportionality, I'm wondering to what extent children with disabilities might be overrepresented among the foster care population. And you know, I'm thinking of learning disabilities, in the whole range, and if that presents special challenges.
Certainly, Chair Tomei and Representative Denbrough, absolutely. When part of what our challenge is with the children in foster care is that many of the children have come in with maybe uncharacteristic educational experiences, lack of school. Many of our kids are actually on individual education plans, IEPs. We also have children who are developmentally disabled, and we work with our partner division within the Department of Human Services for children's programs for disabilities. And so there are, you know, anywhere of 300 or 400 children in family foster care who are identified with development disabilities, and we work with those folks on those. But we really have lots of issues with many of our children around the education, specifically for their IEPs. A lot of foster children have IEPs.
Chair Tomei, Representative Denbrough, I would add that one of the things we also really do struggle with is the fact that a significant portion, and I want to say between 70% and 80% of the young people we serve in foster care have a behavioral health disorder. And so one of our significant efforts it revolves around our ability to work in collaboration with our local mental health providers to do a couple of things. One is to make sure those children receive timely assessments so that we can have an understanding of what it is their needs are, which will allow us then to better meet their needs and allow the foster family and the biological family to address the needs better, as well as the schools, et cetera. We have undertaken some significant improvement efforts around monitoring the number of our children who are on psychotropic medications, trying to understand better how our policies support appropriate prescribing practices by local physicians to make sure that our kids are receiving appropriate treatment. And we're also actively involved in the wraparound initiative, which is an effort to better collaborate with other child-serving agencies to coordinate service delivery, particularly focused on behavioral health issues for children and their families. The goal being, again, that foster care is really supposed to be a temporary experience for a child. And what we want to be sure is that when that child leaves us, that the child and his or her parent are equipped to continue the improvements for that child that have begun with us, the kinds of things like behavioral health supports and treatment. And we really want the biological family to be able to step up and say, we know that with better mental health treatment, you can do better in school. So let's continue and have that continuity of care with the provider at the community level when we walk away, so that the family can continue to meet their child's needs and the child can continue to be successful and hopefully have better mental health outcomes, better education outcomes, et cetera.
And just a quick follow-up. Among the support programs that are in place for training foster parents, is there training in, the variety of disabilities and how to work with them and et cetera? And actually, before you answer that, and also coordination with the schools, is that an area that could be better? I would think that would really be critical.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrough, yes, absolutely. Two questions. One is we have a variety of training opportunities for foster parents. So all foster parents go through a basic core curriculum, which is about 8 weeks of how to care for children in general, how to care for foster children in general, a variety of topics. And then they're also required and provided opportunities for other advanced training courses. And again, the array ranges everywhere from CPR to how to work with older adolescents leaving the system, how to take care of yourself and whatnot. And so we probably don't have as much, it's not as rich of a program as I'd like for a lot of issues. And certainly kids with multiple development disabilities or multiple special needs is certainly one of them. But we do work with a variety of other organizations to make sure that we can get those courses offered to us if possible. Schools certainly is one of those areas where we do have specialized training for foster parents on how to work with schools, how to advocate for your children in schools, and we've used the Juvenile Rights Project to do some of those trainings over the last several years. So it's one thing to go to a school and get the child enrolled. It's a whole other thing to positively advocate for their ongoing needs.
Any further questions? Representative.
Well, just a quickie. Do you also then have the parents, the biological parents, take these classes?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, yes. Biological parents are offered some of the courses, not all of them. Certainly anything with the school, if we can engage them in going to class or going to the school meetings with us, we do that kind of work. Some of the classes we do offer for biological parents, but not all, it's not across the board.
Colleagues, to me, the children in foster care are among the most vulnerable in our state, and I feel a real commitment to them. And I think we may be calling these two people back to talk with us some more. I know you wanted to talk some about training of foster parents. Is that true?
I think what you have in, Chair Tomei, you have in front of you a letter that describes at a very high level some of the direct and indirect supports, and we'd be happy to provide you any follow-up verbally that you would like us to on that.
Great.
That'd be good.
And if there are other issues that you would like us to deal with in about foster care, I would hope you would let me know that, and we will seek more information on that. In the meantime, thank you so much. It's been a very helpful presentation. Any other questions or comments for the good of the order? If
no,
not,
your hair looks nice today. You know, got hair.
Oh.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, with that, I will close the committee and the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you very much.
I got my haircut.